Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Help me understand something for a minute, will you, everybody? The economy is still shaky, right? The recession is still fresh in our memories. And yet last year was the best ever for American retail? Also on the broadcast today, a private equity primer and attitude check, our partnership with the good people at Gallup from American Public Media. This is Marketplace.
Let Marketplace be your guide to the modern world. Subscribe to the Marketplace Tech Report podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Welcome to the Marketplace podcast for Thursday, the 12th of January. And courtesy of the Commerce Department this morning came the final tally on retail sales for the year gone by. Almost $5 trillion with the T dollars up 8% from 2010. And yet, there were a lot of frowny faces on Wall Street today because the way they see it there, December, the month of month for retailers, was a dud. Our senior business correspondent Bob Moon has today's economic glass half empty or glass half full story.
If the economic recovery is oh so fragile, how in the world did we shatter the record for retail sales last year? Turns out we put a lot of that money not necessarily toward things we wanted to buy, but essentials we had to buy. And a lot of those things simply cost more.
There's a number of things we're paying more for, but we're not getting as much.
Economist Joel Naroff says food and fuel get factored out of the inflation numbers, but anyone who went to a grocery store or gas station last year often had to pay more. So does that really reflect healthy consumption?
Some of it was empty calories, in the respect that some of it went to pay for higher gasoline prices, especially in the first half of 2011.
In fact, retail sales of gasoline jumped nearly 18% year over year. Naroff is quick to add that's only part of the picture, though. The government's report is a broad gauge that covers everything from auto dealers and department stores to restaurants and bars. So Naroff says 2011 was an important turning point for the country's economic recovery.
The consumer finally decided it was time to spend again. They opened their wallets, blew out the dust, found that they actually had some credit cards, went to the stores, and started buying.
Wells Fargo economist Tim Quinlan worries that we started dipping into our savings early in the holiday shopping season and then seemed to get a sudden case of frugality in December. But he still thinks some of his colleagues on Wall Street are too pessimistic on the heels of such a strong year.
Consumers are certainly losing momentum a little bit, but that doesn't mean that they're, you know, going into hiding. Consumers are going to continue to spend. The pace of that spending growth is probably not going to be super robust. And candidly, I don't know that it should be. Part of what got us into this mess to begin with was consumers taking on far too much debt.
Quinlan says the steady spending growth we're still seeing is nothing to complain about. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
In Haiti today, it's a national day of mourning to mark the earthquake of 2 years ago. Hundreds of millions of dollars in aid has been donated since then, most of it from foreign governments, to be sure, but a good part of it from people through online donations and regular checks, and for the first time, via text message. It's quick, it's easy, and according to a new study, pretty popular. Sally Herships reports.
Here's why the Red Cross loves your cell phone.
So many people today walk around with their mobile device pretty much molded to their hands.
Roger Lau works for the Red Cross.
They do everything with that, and this is a way for them to give.
After the earthquake hit Haiti, the Text to Haiti campaign raised over $40 million. Nearly 1 in 10 adults has donated money using a mobile phone, according to the study. It was conducted by the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard and the Pew Internet and American Life Project. One reason some people are so quick to give, it's easy. No checks to mail in, no online forms to fill out.
It's easier than any other way of giving. You can do it. It probably takes you 10 seconds to do it.
Rob Ferris is research director at the Berkman Center. He says people who texted donations to Haiti are not your typical charitable donors. For one thing, they're much younger.
They didn't need to own a credit card or even have a bank account.
Aaron Smith is a researcher at the Pew Internet American Life Project. He says for charitable givers, donating via text is pure impulse.
They're sitting around, they're watching TV or talking to their friends, and something really bad comes up, and they see, you know, really images of destruction or things that really grab them in a personal way.
So they text $10, and they tell their friends about it, who also give. Rob Lau from the Red Cross says most texted donations come from new donors. Researcher Aaron Smith says it can be hard for charities to form long-term relationships with impulse givers, but they can be counted on to be close to their phones when disasters happen. In New York, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
Even if you don't know a whole lot about contemporary art, you might have heard of Damien Hirst. He's a British artist who, among other things, has decorated a human skull with $23 million worth of diamonds. He's put a 14-foot tiger shark in formaldehyde and sliced a sheep in half. Strange? Yes. Profitable? Oh, you better believe it. Because even apart from his art, Hirst is known for his marketing. And he launched his latest campaign today, hundreds of what he calls spot paintings. Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith has the story.
The Damien Hirst paintings feature patterns of multicolored spots. They all look a little like the game of Twister. Starting today, these paintings go on display all over the world at the prestigious Gagosian Galleries.
It is the return of Damien Hirst to the center of the art market.
I visited a gallery in New York with Marian Maneker, publisher of the Art Market Monitor. He says the last time Hirst made headlines was in 2008 with a splashy auction at Sotheby's. It took place the very day investment bank Lehman Brothers collapsed and the financial crisis began. Despite the timing, it was a wild success.
He sold $200 million worth of work. That was equal to his previous 2 or 3 years of sales.
The spot show has 300 paintings, 100 are for sale, anywhere from $100,000 to a couple million. And there's a twist. Anyone who visits all 11 Gagosian galleries, from Hong Kong to Geneva to New York, will get a signed Damien Hirst print.
I am in a cab on my way to the gallery.
Christina Ruiz is an editor at the London-based publication, The Art Newspaper. She's taking the spot challenge. The gallery trotting costs thousands of dollars. Still, Ruiz says, more than 300 people have signed up.
Hirst has made the market for art his real subject. If you think of his diamond skull for the love of God, which he priced at 50 million British pounds.
The spot paintings are nothing new. Hirst has been producing them for more than 20 years. David Gallinson is an economist at the University of Chicago. He says the real news here is the show itself and the Starbucks-style card that gets stamped with each gallery visit.
Hirst keeps coming up with new ideas, more in marketing than in art, you know, and it's interesting that this is now the spot paintings rather than some new form of art. He hasn't come up with a new form of art.
In other words, Damien Hirst has elevated marketing to an art form. In New York, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
The aforementioned retail sales report and a couple of other mixed bag indicators kept Wall Street in check today. The major indices ended just a bit higher than where they started. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. We've been talking about the future this week, the future of television to be precise, and what the TVs of tomorrow that are being rolled out at the Consumer Electronics Show in Las Vegas this week are going to mean for what we'll be watching. Today, though, the television viewer of the future. Youth Radio's Rihanna Godfrey brings us the story.
I am laying in my room. You know, this is basically my dojo, my sanctuary, my place to go. TV's on. Computer's on, I'm on YouTube, Facebook, Twitter, and Tumblr all at one time. I always have my TV on in the background, but when it's not entertaining enough, I get on YouTube. Let's see what I can find on YouTube. Yeah, this is the whole episode.
Do you know who else likes to clean up other people's messes? My mom!
That's one of my favorite TV shows. A series on Cartoon Network called Regular Show. I watch it on TV when I can, but if I miss it, I can always count on YouTube to have an episode. And online, there are no commercials. Another one of my favorite shows is The Misadventures of Awkward Black Girl, and it's not even possible to watch it on TV. Episodes are only online, and they're great.
Fixated intimacy delusion is quite common with women, and various species of penguins.
But penguins don't even fly.
It's still pretty normal.
Issa Rae, the creator and star, raised the money to produce the show from donations on the website Kickstarter. If I couldn't watch different shows on my computer, I'd be so bored. But right down the hall, my granny is content with just the basics.
Granny.
What are you doing?
Do you watch a lot of TV?
Yes, I do.
How much TV do you watch?
Too much.
And do you... What are your favorite things to watch?
X Factor, game shows, Law and Order. I watch everything that come on TV.
Do you just watch your regular TV? Do you do Netflix or anything?
No, I don't do Netflix. I don't do anything I have to pay extra money for.
So you're keeping it traditional?
Yes, I am.
My granny and I are pretty different when it comes to TV. She can sit through endless commercials. Not me. I skip channels until all the commercials are over. My granny has always been loyal to just watching regular television. I mean, really regular. She canceled our subscriptions to HBO and Stars and refuses to watch Netflix, even though we have it in the house. But my mom is a different story.
So, hey, Mama.
Hey, Rihanna.
She's the one who told me about Awkward Black Girl. She even watches TV on her iPhone while we're out and about, something I don't do yet.
Okay, so you watch Netflix on your phone?
Yes.
So you know I don't do that, right?
Right, you're bootsy.
What does bootsy mean?
Not cool.
So, you're cooler than me?
Yes, I am.
I look up to you, Mom.
You should.
Thank you.
I love you, bye.
And if not so young moms are hip to online television, shouldn't that be a clue that viewing habits are most certainly on the move? In Vallejo, California, I'm Rihanna Godfrey for Marketplace.
Rihanna's story was produced for us by Youth Radio. Here's a not-so-theoretical question about the future of television and the future viewers of television like Rihanna Godfrey. How do you suppose it's all going to be paid for? Ads of some kind, most likely. Janice Suter is the director of media technology at the ad firm GSD&M down in Houston, Texas. She's at the CES in Las Vegas this week, though. Janice, thanks for being here.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So that story that we just heard, I mean, what lessons do you take out of that as a professional in the advertising business? I mean, it sort of sounds like you've got your work cut out for you with young kids.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, think about when we were kids, we really didn't have the kind of choice and control over our media. And, you know, I don't know if I have the brain capacity to be able to take in so much content at one time in so many different formats.
Yeah. Does it make your job harder, though?
Oh, absolutely. Oh, yeah. Gosh. The younger generation, I think really a lot of people, including myself, are engaging in, you know, Twitter while they're watching television. And right. It's a way to enhance the experience. So they might be looking for, you know, additional information on a character or people following a certain hashtag, what they're saying about a program as it's happening.
Do you worry at all that their attention span is so fractured? Not that they can't pay attention, right? I sound like the whole, you know, hey, you kids, get off my lawn. but there's so much going on in their lives, right?
Exactly.
I mean, they've got Twitter and Tumblr and Facebook and all this stuff. How do you get their attention?
Well, I mean, I think the key is to draw them in enticing ways within content that they're interested in. I mean, it's literally going against that whole broadcast model where you're being really yelled at in a one-way format, but maybe, you know, making branded content on a gaming platform, for example, or something playful or edgy. But again, it all goes back to that intimacy with the consumer and with their mindset and what makes them tick.
I wonder if younger viewers today are savvier about advertising just because they've been swamped by, you know, really good, clever ads for basically their whole lives.
Yeah, absolutely. They're pretty savvy at avoiding. But think about ad avoidance has been going on forever. I myself, you know, when I schedule my TiVo program, I'm going to start watching it 20 minutes after it starts. You know, it's very strategic. You know, the younger generation, they're just more selective about how they spend their time. We just have to find more creative ways to break through, considering all the various inputs that they're getting all at one time and the attention span issues as well. Digital is like a, you know, blank slate. There's lots of new inventory that we can discover along with our vendor partners, with our content partners, and then it becomes an adopted, you know, standard media platform. So we're helping to change the business.
You know, there's all this talk about young viewers now. You have to have them. But the last time I checked, 15 and 18-year-olds didn't have a whole lot of disposable income, right? So why, I mean, youth is good and all that stuff, but why do you need the young viewers? Why the push?
Well, I mean, I think it's growing brand advocates, you know, from a young age. I have two daughters that are 9 and 11, and they have a pretty powerful influence on me, and a lot of money that I spend is for them, and it's, you know, they are influenced by advertising. We need to be responsible in our marketing to kids, but absolutely they have an influence on their parents and their pocketbook.
Jenna Suter, she's the director of digital media technology at GSD&M. It's an ad firm based out of Houston, Texas. We got her at the CES, the Consumer Electronics Show, going on in Vegas this week. Jenna, thanks a lot.
Great. Thank you.
Coming up, name three things about the economy that are bugging you right now.
Number one, over a quarter of Americans spontaneously said it was jobs and employment. Number two, the second category was the debt and deficit. And number three was politics.
Our weekly check-in with Gallup. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials rose 21 points this Thursday, almost 0.2%, finished at 12,471. The NASDAQ up 13 points, about 0.5%, 2724. The S&P 500 also up 3 points, 0.25%, ended things at 1295. Get ready for bank earnings tomorrow en avance. Goldman Sachs pulled up almost 1.5% today. Citigroup rose 1%. J.P. Morgan Chase lifted 0.5% today. Chevron issued a profit warning and burned off 2.6%. ConocoPhillips fell 1.75%. ExxonMobil drained off 0.4% today. Across the pond, London's FTSE fell 0.1%. France's CAC 40, la même chose, down 0.1%. Bonds fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 1.92%. No, I don't know why I was speaking French. You're listening to Marketplace.
Do you enjoy the music we play between stories? Visit the Marketplace Music section to browse playlists for all of our programs and to buy those songs on Amazon. A percentage of each purchase goes towards supporting our programs. Find more online at marketplace.org/music.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Friday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on international trade for November. How are consumers feeling about the economy? The University of Michigan releases its preliminary January consumer sentiment survey. And on January 13, 1968, Johnny Cash played at Folsom State Prison. Perhaps you've heard the live album. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media, APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. You remember how we told you yesterday super PACs are changing the dynamics of presidential campaigns, that they can spend almost as much as they want on almost whatever they want to further the candidate of their choice? Well, the super PAC in the news today is called Winning Our Future. It supports, to the tune of millions of dollars, would-be Republican nominee Newt Gingrich. And it's doing so most prominently with a 28-minute video it released today criticizing Mitt Romney and the private equity firm he founded, Bain Capital. Those two words, private equity, are defining at least this leg of the Republican primaries. But what private equity is and what it does isn't always so clear. So we've called Josh Rao to explain. He teaches finance at the Kellogg School of Management. It's at Northwestern University. Josh, good to have you with us.
Thanks. Good to be here, Kai.
All right. So in simplest possible terms, what is private equity?
Well, private equity is when a group of partners or people with some money buy companies with the idea of selling those companies back to other people in the future for a profit. Simple as that.
All right. Well, maybe that was a little too short. Is there an analogy that's going to help me understand this a little bit?
Sure. Well, I guess it would be kind of like buying a used car and fixing up the car, selling it back to somebody else in the future. But there's some key differences with that. You know, first of all, the people who buy companies in private equity funds, they are raising money from outside investors to do this. So instead of buying the car with my own pocket money, I would be going out to wealthy investors. In the case of private equity, these are pension funds and endowments, like the California Public Employee Retirement System, which invests money on behalf of public sector employees. Other investors include sovereign wealth funds and university endowments. And raising money from them, buying companies with that money, selling those companies back later, hopefully for a profit, splitting the proceeds with the investors who gave me the money in the first place.
All right. Well, but the thing about private equity, though, is that they don't always fix things up, right? I mean, the big knock that surely you've been reading about in the papers is that private equity goes in and they strip out costs, they get their profit out, and then they spin it around and go back to the market.
Well, the discussions that are going on about private equity today are happening in a very politicized environment. On the one hand, you have supporters of Mitt Romney who are painting private equity as being this glorious thing where companies are bought and thousands of new jobs are being created. And on the other hand, you have opponents who want to try to paint private equity in a very negative light and see that argue that thousands of jobs are being destroyed. Now, what that really masks is the fact that there is a huge range of activity that goes on in private equity. And academic studies have shown that on average, you know, the employment effects of private equity are really very small. So on average, there's really not much evidence that private equity either creates a lot of jobs or destroys a lot of jobs.
Well, when private equity funds send out a prospectus or whatever they send out, do they list in there somewhere we're going to create jobs, or do they say we're going to maximize return for our investors?
The stated goal of private equity is always the maximization of return for investors. There is no stated objective of private equity to create jobs. And you can imagine profitable investments that involve job creation and ones that don't involve job creation. And the reality is that there is just a vast range of types of private equity and different strategies of trying to buy companies and make money from those purchases and sales. The fact that it's called private equity reflects the fact that the information about these transactions is largely private. The only really good source of all of the transactions is going to be the investors themselves.
The firms themselves, though, they do all right. They get, what, 2% of all investments and 20% of profits is the standard rule.
That's the standard rule.
Which, when you're talking big investments, is a whole lot of money.
Certainly. But private equity investors also have skills. You know, anybody who tries to get into the business realizes that it's actually quite difficult to make money in private equity.
Joshua Rao teaches finance at the Kellogg School at Northwestern University. Josh, thanks a lot.
Thanks very much, Kai.
All the talk about private equity notwithstanding, if you ask around to regular folk, the economy is right at the top of the list of things Americans care about. But as we have said, the American economy is a giant beast, a multifaceted thing. So what exactly is it about the economy that people worry about?
And the latest poll numbers suggest
margin of error.
There is somewhat of a disconnect.
It's conventional wisdom.
Our survey said...
Every week, we find out how Americans feel about things with the help of Frank Newport. He's the editor-in-chief at Gallup, and it's a segment we call Attitude Check. Frank, good to have you back again.
Hi, good to be with you.
So if the economy is the biggest problem that people are thinking of, what is it about the economy? What do we know?
We ask Americans just that question. What worries you most about the economy? Because we were scratching our heads as well. We know Americans, although they're a little more positive, are in angst about the economy. Yeah. They continue to be so. What is it? Well, I can tell you what they responded. No shock. Number one, over a quarter of Americans spontaneously said it was jobs and employment. Number two, the second category was the debt and deficit. And number three was politics. People mentioned Obama not handling the things right on the economy. Those were Republicans. And then a lot of Democrats said Congress and bickering in Washington. So actually right up there with the big two, jobs and debt, is concern about bickering in D.C.
Let me drill down a little bit in order. That first item, jobs and employment. Do you know if people feel differently about this, whether they have jobs or not?
Generally speaking, people who are unemployed, and actually, you know, it's a small percent, 8% of Americans, are more worried about jobs than those who are not. But again, the bulk of Americans have jobs, and that's what drives the overall concern. So it's a lot of people out there with jobs who still say that what worries them most is jobs.
On the debt issue, that number two item, is it the short-term problem we seem to be in with annual deficits in the trillions of dollars, or is it the longer term we're just borrowing way much more than we're taking in?
We think it's the latter. These are much more likely to be Republicans, Kai, who volunteer that the biggest economic worry is the debt and the deficit. And generally, Republicans are thinking about the big picture in deficit and long-term borrowing and what have you, not the short-term inability to balance the budget.
Right. And finally, this number three item, politics. Is it to the point now, do you think, where in November there will be a throw-the-bums-out movement?
Well, but which bums?
Okay, fair enough.
It was a lot easier in 2010 because the Democrats controlled both the House and the Senate, and then they at least threw out the people that controlled the House and turned it over to the Republicans. But now we have divided government, so we don't know. It's a fascinating question. People are really down on politics, but who they're going to throw out is going to be the fascinating question that we'll monitor as the year goes on.
Yeah. I wanted to ask you quickly before we go about an item that you guys talked about in the first week of January here. You're seeing people are more confident about their standard of living and the possibility that it's going to rise since the new year?
Absolutely. This is important. It may be short term, but we had the highest standard of living index that we have measured at Gallup since early in 2008. We have over half of Americans who say their standard of living is getting better. And we have to go back, as I mentioned, to the early months, January and February of 2008, to find optimism that high about standard of living. So something's in the water, at least initially in this great year 2012, making Americans pretty positive.
Frank Newport, the editor-in-chief at Gallup. Our segment that we do with them is called Attitude Check, and you can find that on our website. It's marketplace.org. Frank, thanks a lot.
My pleasure.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, which comes with the acknowledgement that very few of us would like to hear our words from 5 years ago read back to us. But then again, very few of us were the president of the New York Federal Reserve back then, much less Secretary of the Treasury right now. Yes, the unlucky quotee is Timothy Geithner, and we know what he said 5 years ago because the minutes of Alan Greenspan's last meeting as chairman of the Federal Reserve were released today. There are tributes galore to the outgoing chairman in the minutes, including this one from Geithner. It's a quote, too. "I'd like the record to show," he told Greenspan, "that I think you're pretty terrific." And then he goes on, "The risk that we decide in the future that you're even better than we think is higher than the alternative," which shows you how much change happens in 5 years, I guess. All right, that's Marketplace from APM, American Public Media. Today, the Dow up 21 points, almost 0.2%. The NASDAQ up 13 points, about 0.5%. The S&P 500 also up 0.75%. Ben Adair, John Buckley, Nancy Fargali, Stephen Gregory, John Haas, Jonathan Karp, Betsy Streisand, Lisa Tucker, and Celeste Wesson are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is George Judson. You can tune in tomorrow to the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest in business and economic news. And coming up back here next time, tomorrow's Friday. You know what that means, our weekly wrap of Wall Street and beyond. Also, what the economy looks like from behind the wheel of a big rig out in Iowa. I'm Kai Rizdahl. I do hope you can join us for that tomorrow. This is APM. That's American Public Media.